Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer. Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Alexandra Shulman, the journalist, author and former editor-in-chief of British Vogue. She was the longest-serving editor in the history of the publication. Alexandra, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And we'll start where we always start, at the very beginning. Can you tell us your earliest memories of food?
Well, I've always loved food. So I think my earliest memories were my parents' flat or home.
You grew up
in
London.
When I was a child, grew up in London. And I was thinking about this the other day, and we had, at that stage, we lived in central London, and you got deliveries. So with, like, the butcher would come and would deliver the meat, and we had a mincer, one sort of big mincer that you clamped on the kitchen table, and he'd grind the mince, and then the greengrocer would deliver the groceries. And it was a small flat, so I was very aware of sort of food. It wasn't like it wasn't part of our life, having food. So I just remember the deliveries. I think that was my earliest memory.
Who was the cook in your house?
My mum.
And was she good?
My mum's a brilliant cook. She came from the generation that was completely in thrall, really, to Elizabeth David. And so she was a sort of wartime child and had a pretty kind of grim British sort of menu, and then discovered the joys of sort of continental cooking. So everything was always kind of slow cooked and lots of garlic and lots of herbs. And she never cooked anything ready-made. Everything was always cooked fresh.
And I assume she must have been a very good host, because she was the author of this book, which we've got a copy of here, Lady Behave, A Guide to Modern Manners. I mean, did she like to throw a party?
Well, it's very odd that Mum actually is one of the people who they never entertained. My parents were both journalists, and my dad was a large part of my childhood was a theatre critic. So he was out sort of four or five nights a week at the theatre. And so they couldn't really have dinner parties. And my mum worked very hard too. So oddly enough, although she wrote a guide to sort of social life and manners, in fact, her life was very much about work, and the cooking was very much sort of for the family.
I mean, the book's got some amazing advice in it. There's advice on things like jacket potatoes and smoking in public now that Princess Margaret has made it fashionable. I mean, did you read this book? Did you sort of imbibe the advice in it?
I think we all read it kind of and thought it was quite funny when we were kids. But I've delved into it again the other day to check something for a book that I'm writing on clothes at the moment. And I have to say I was completely gripped by it, because it's that kind of thing when you read quite recent history, and it just seems a world away. I mean, the formality and the kind of the life that the people she was writing for led, it sounded so kind of privileged.
Your father was the son of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants. Did that have any effect on the food you ate at home, or the way in which you ate, or if your mother was the main cook, perhaps not at all?
No, my dad literally didn't know how to make a piece of toast. So his sort of upbringing and his, to some extent, tastes in food were not really part of our menu. But he was also quite unadventurous in his food taste. So we would always have, like, you know, meat and potatoes and veg and stuff. And I remember when I was young, I'd always say to Mum, why can't you cook something like a risotto or pasta or something like that? And she said, well, your father doesn't like it. And I just say, that's insane. You know, why are you making your life so difficult?
And what about school food? Did you enjoy school food?
No, I don't think our school food was very nice. My favourite food at school was, I remember having these Pyrex bowls on the table of mashed potato with the most sort of delicious kind of pools of butter on the top of them. That was the only good thing at school. My first school food was really, truly awful. It was a school around the corner. It got closed down, I suspect, for health and safety reasons, actually. And we got boiled macaroni and hot milk every day for lunch. Wow. So that was disgusting.
I think that's probably the bleakest school meal we've heard so far on the podcast. We've heard some bleak stuff.
Properly bad with tapioca.
Oh gosh.
Even worse.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't think you could make it worse, but they succeeded. And what about eating out? Is it right you didn't eat in a restaurant until you were 15?
That's probably right, yes. I don't know where you got that information from, but that's probably pretty right, because I think, you know, it was a very different time then. I mean, there just weren't the same number of restaurants. There was no culture of eating out. And I was thinking, with the news of Pizza Express at the moment sort of having a difficult time, that I remember when pizza came to this country and it was a sort of, you know, huge discovery that the whole Pizza Express chain, that you could go and get something like pizza and it was relatively inexpensive. Ditto hamburgers. I mean, I wasn't brought up at a time when it was just easy to go out and eat. So if you did, it would have been a proper kind of, you know, proper meal that certainly somebody would cost quite a lot of money.
So you need an occasion for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And how about in your early days working as a journalist? I mean, was there a lot of dining out at that stage?
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, I feel so sorry for all you young journalists now. It was so much more fun then. No, we went out to lunch every day. And even if we didn't go out to lunch for work, we would go out to lunch, just people in the office, practically every day. In fact, I was me and Mary Killen were sort of shooting the breeze over it the other day about the sort of memories of how, because she worked on Tatler at the same time as I did, and we'd sort of all go out and have spaghetti bolognese around the corner and a couple of glasses of red wine, and that was just kind of regular. So we did do a lot of eating and a lot of drinking.
Sounds great fun.
And when you were at Vogue, you've said that you felt under pressure to be a domestic goddess. Was that in terms of how you presented yourself, or cooking at home, or having it all?
Gosh, I don't remember saying that. I don't think I did feel under pressure to be a domestic goddess. A goddess, maybe.
Oh, I'll have to words our research. Did you cook at home when you were working at Vogue?
Oh, yeah, always. I mean, I've always cooked. Well, actually, I really started to cook a lot, I suppose, in my late 20s, early 30s. And then once I had a child, everybody starts to cook more after that. But I think what I possibly would have meant then was that you were sort of meant to be good at everything, not just sort of your work, but it also sort of pressure on being a successful homemaker, actually, but probably more than a cook.
Do you enjoy cooking?
Thinking about cooking the other day, I cook most nights. If I'm in, I cook. And I find it quite therapeutic, but not in the way that people, you know, people always say, oh, I just love getting whatever's in the fridge and I kind of meditative, chopping the onions and the carrots and just throwing it all together. I don't feel like that at all about it. I find cooking, thinking about what to eat and everything quite tiring and not that interesting. But because it's so mundane, I find it quite stress relieving. But I'm not I'm a perfectly all right cook. Borderline better than all right, but not good.
And how about when you're at Vogue? I mean, I suppose the sort of stereotype is everyone sort of surviving on coffee and not much else. But what was the reality like at Vogue when it came to food?
I'm trying to remember, actually. Well, I think, again, when I first got to Vogue, again, there was more kind of eating out. I mean, lunch, a lot of people would go out to lunch one way and another, which sort of decreased both through kind of, I guess, everyone's expenses being cut as time went by, but also the sort of, when I arrived, we were all the people that came with me were probably younger, maybe not that many of them had children. As everyone sort of got older, a lot of my staff stayed with me. Everyone had other preoccupations. So you start to get into that thing where you actually want to get through your day as quickly as you can and get home. So sort of lunch became perhaps a bit less of a thing. There are always cakes in the office, normally delivered, for somebody would be delivering boxes of Krispy Kreme donuts or cupcakes and everything. And interestingly, they always went. I mean, people always thought, oh, Vogue, nobody's ever going to, you know, eat a carb. But in fact, everyone's noshing on whatever. They didn't want to buy it themselves. But if it was there, they went really quickly.
And how, I mean, you say that this idea that no one tweeted carb, and Lara mentioned the perception that everyone survives on coffee. How did you feel about fat eating and diet culture when you were heading, well, now as well, but also when you were heading up Vogue?
Well, I made a rule that we wouldn't publish any diets. I thought that it was very important that, as a fashion magazine and magazine read by a lot of women, and particularly very kind of influential for young women, that we weren't trying to tell people that they should in some way restrain what they were eating. So we never ran diets. I hired Nigella as our food writer, and she was one of my most successful hires. And actually after her, I found it very hard to find somebody that I could sort of fill her shoes with. So we sort of, and also there was a much more of a growth in food writing everywhere. And so we didn't have recipes for about the last kind of 10 years of my, about the last 10 years of my being at Vogue. But I thought that food was something we wrote about it in a kind of social observation way quite a lot. I think it's really interesting, food. I think people's attitudes to eating together, to not eating, to sort of who you eat with. I find all of that really interesting.
Mm. And there must be lots of parties and lunches when you're at Vogue. I mean, was that fun, or was it sort of quite high pressure at times?
No, I love a party, and we gave a lot of parties, and a lot of parties with food as well. So there was always going off on those.
Unlike the Spectator party.
known for just being
the odd crisp. Yeah. No, we'd go off to these sort of huge kind of places that you get caterers, places in sort of warehouses in Battersea, where everyone would bring you not just the whole meal you were going to have, but four iterations of it. So by the time you'd done sort of 3 hours of start sampling, you were just kind of, oh my God, I've got to get out of here. But we did, part of the job of editing Vogue increasingly became about entertaining and socialising, definitely.
And who do you enjoy reading as food writers now?
Okay, so many, but I guess right now I'm adoring Diana Henry. I think she's really brilliant, and I've just been trying to cook some recipes from her new book.
It's good.
It's very good, from oven to table.
From the the toad and the leek and cheddar toad in the hole we made last week. Very good.
You recommend that?
I really recommend
it. Okay, so I tried the very good thing with peas, radishes, and spring onions and fillet of lamb.
Yes,
and delicious braised peas. Anyway, big fan of hers. Nigel Slater, I think, is really good. Still my favourite cookbook is Nigella's How to Eat. I mean, I refer to it again and again and again.
So good.
It's got everything.
And you can just read, you can just keep reading it.
We've just done it recently on audiobook with her reading it.
Because it's the anniversary.
No, I bet that's good.
And what do you like to cook when you're at home? Because you've got a son. Do you enjoy cooking for him?
So we cook. So we have a very kind of limited weekly menu. It'll be like steak one day, sausages the next, roast chicken. Then we'll try and sort of do a sort of veggie kind of mixture of quinoa, chickpeas, pine nuts, whatever I can find, shove it in. And then probably once a week, I guess, I'll cook something a bit more interesting. But we always have salad. My mum always had salad, and we always have salad, and I've had the same salad bowl for like, I guess now 30 years, so we use every night. And David, who I live with, the only thing he can make is salad dressing, and he makes a really good salad dressing, but it is literally the only thing. So we have that. And I never serve starters, first courses, always go straight into a main course when I have people to eat. And we have people to eat quite a lot, like at least once a week.
One of the things your mother says in the book is the modern hostess now is also the cook, the waitress, and the washer-up. I mean, does that apply to you as well?
Do you think very much so, yeah, very much so, all of the above.
And how about eating out? I mean, what's your favourite restaurant? Have you got a few places you always go to?
Yes, we go... Well, I love... it's interesting, I've sort of analysed that... Mainly, I like restaurants where they know me and where people are nice to me. That's kind of more my priority than anything else. So I'm relatively unadventurous but sort of really striking out and very, very different restaurants. So a lot of old favourites like Clark's in Kensington, which I've been going to since I was in my 20s, and still the Wolseley, for instance, and the Caprice I go to a lot. We've got a wonderful local, little tiny local Italian called Ida, which is like a sort of family kind of, it's run by Simonetta and her family, and it's all kind of really pastas, and it's actually become very popular now, but that's one of our favourites as well. And there's a place we go to a lot, David and I, called Kate, which is a Persian restaurant in Maida Vale.
Do you travel much now? Do you go on holiday?
I've been on more holiday since I left Vogue than I ever did when I was at Vogue, yeah.
And are you adventurous in terms of eating destinations, or is that never really the priority?
I don't think food's a priority ever when we travel, but we always try and eat well and, you know, do a bit of research. And I was just in Lisbon with my son and his girlfriend. We all went in June, I think it was. And they were very good. They found this sort of fantastic kind of hole-in-the-wall kind of place that was totally sort of off the radar, which had really amazing food. But the only thing is that you had to kind of queue up in order to get your name on a wait list, you know, on the night. And then you got your name on the wait list, and then you had to queue up longer to wait to get your table. So, I mean, it was really like they were really making you sweat it. And I was saying to Sam, you know, I just don't think I care enough about the food to be doing this. But when we got in there, it was really good.
Was
it's called Taberna, yes.
Sounds great.
Taberna.
And just finally, if you're putting together your ideal meal, what would it involve?
Kind of depends what my meal would be for. So, you know, our everyday meal that sort of makes everyone feel happy is roast chicken, because it just is. And my mum made a really good roast chicken, and I make a really good roast chicken, and it's really easy to do. So that's a sort of, in a way, my favourite. But I think my favourite meal would probably be very influenced by who is coming to eat, in fact, and what, you know, what I think they would like. I have to say that now it is incredibly complicated with everybody having different kind of food tolerances and, you know, opinions about what, even if they can eat it, if they don't want to eat it, it's kind of a nightmare. You know, suddenly you've got to cook a dinner for 8 people, and one's a vegetarian, one's a celiac, one doesn't do carbs, one doesn't do fish. I mean, it's suddenly like, maybe bring your own.
8 different meals.
And we need a new version of this, sort of updated for
modern era. It'd be quite good, wouldn't it, to have a sort of manners book for the new, for the all of this kind of thing, yeah.
So, Alexandra, finally, tell us about your latest project.
So I'm working, just about to finish a book called Clothes and Other Things That Matter. And it's a memoir about my life and my time at Vogue. But more specifically, it's about clothes and the way they sort of, how we feel about them and how they fit into our lives. And I was thinking, you know, coming here, about the apron that I've been writing about, and how aprons sort of started off as something that nobody who was in any way smart would ever wish to be seen in. And now, you know, people wear aprons simply sort of slightly because they want to look like somebody who's cooking, even if in fact they never do cook. And all of that idea of domesticity as a kind of, as a lifestyle choice rather than necessity, a status symbol almost, is really interesting to me. All of the people like Mrs. Hinch and things like that, and all the armchair cooks that are out there. And it's such a change from how domestic life was regarded. And the apron's a sort of symbol of all that.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. Alexandra Shulman's new book, Clothes and Other Things That Matter, will be available in April 2020 and is published by Octopus.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.